be aware that if you ask the question, your voice may be audible on the Light a Candle podcast. Welcome to the OA Light a Candle Meeting podcast. Visit our website at oalaig.org where you will find links to prior podcasts from this meeting available in multiple formats. The opinions expressed on the Light a Candle podcast are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. I would now like to introduce our speaker for tonight, Lucy!
Hi, I'm Lucy. I'm a compulsive overeater.
Hi, Lucy.
Hi, everybody. Welcome. Welcome especially to the newcomers. I think it's Sasha, Chuck, Gigi, and Trinity. Congratulations. Congratulations for being here. I came here about 18 years ago, and I sat in the back, kind of behind Heather there in the corner in the dark, and then I would leave really, really early so that nobody would talk to me. Because I was just so scared, and I didn't think I could do this, you know. So, congratulations to the chip takers. For those of us who are not on the podcast, there was, I think, 78 years of abstinence tonight between two different people, or 75, something like that. So that's really thrilling. So it's amazing to be here. As I said before, this is my home meeting. I first came here in 2006. I came because, actually, the first OA meeting I ever went to was in 1986, and it totally freaked me out, completely freaked me out. I wanted to eat pizza. I wanted to go eat large omelets. Oh, congratulations to Miami, too, to the chip takers. Congratulations. And to get the numbers out of the way, I have been abstinent 16 years. I just had a birthday, January 28th. Thank you. I have had the same sponsor for 16 years. It's not something that I necessarily recommend. It's just part of my story. It has worked really, really well for me. I know that's not true for a lot of people, and that works well for them. It just happens to be a part of my story. Let's see what else. My abstinence is breakfast, lunch, dinner, and an optional snack. I usually take the optional snack, but definitely not always. I try not to have the optional snack be something like a treat, be something like a brownie, which I had this week. I try not to do that. I try to definitely make it something that gets me from one meal to the next. I've worn a size 6. I've worn a size 16. I'm a normal body size now. I'm a size 10. Okay, so I grew up in a family of compulsive overeaters. I don't like to take their inventory, but if you force me, I would say that they are. My mother, my aunt, my grandmother, I have cousins who have the flip side of the disease, who are restrictors and anorexics. There was a lot of food obsession, a lot. And there was a lot of feeling that food would conquer all, and that was how I got through my childhood, is that food conquered all. And so when I would be sad or upset, my mother would offer me something to eat. My grandmother would, you know, cook us up something really delicious, like avocado sandwiches with mayonnaise, you know, or make homemade ice cream. Or she would take us to Baskin-Robbins because she wanted to go. And we would get, I am going to mention food, so just hold on. So we would get English toffee ice cream, and it was incredibly special. And she would keep all the money in her bra, and she would pull out like $50 bills. And back in the day, like $50, that was like a lot of money. It was like a lot of money. So that's how I grew up, and a lot of obsession about cooking. When I was very young, my dad joined a program called the Peace Corps, which is to volunteer overseas to be of humanitarian aid. And so at the age of 6, I went overseas. And that was, it was dangerous physically. I would have worms. I would have some really, really severe childhood diseases, rheumatic fever, pneumonia, bronchitis, really bad dysentery. There was limited medical care. The facilities, the hygiene facilities were also limited. I mean, we lived in a very nice house. I mean, it was, when I say very nice, it sounds like something in Brentwood. No, no, but it had toilets. It had toilets. Now, mine was a squat toilet, but it had toilets, and that was the way it worked. So that was kind of the way it was for me, and I was really, really, really lonely. And two things got me through. One was ballet, and I started taking ballet. And I didn't appear when I was younger to have it. I'm really starting early. It's like six. I got to get to eight by the time it's, you know, 20 minutes from now. But so I didn't appear to have any problems with my weight at that time, but I used food to soothe myself. And I remember one of the times that I really felt my mother really understood me is they had no milk there. There was no pasteurized milk, but they had evaporated milk that they would freeze and turn into this incredibly bogus ice cream. But if you ate about half of it, you wouldn't notice. And it had those red and green pieces in it like fruitcake, which was really disgusting, but if you had nothing else, that was good enough. And she said, you know, Lucy, I know you would really want to go get a sundae. Would you like to go get a sundae? And I remember thinking, oh, my mom loves me, and she, you know, wants to do something for me. For some reason, and I can't tell you why, I can't tell you if this has anything to do with my parents or not, because my brother and sister had a different relationship, but I felt totally alone growing up. I felt totally alone and really lonely. And what helped me with this was this ballet, and I read a ton of fantasy books, you know, elves and fairies and kind of Lord of the Rings for six-year-olds. And then when I got old enough, I would read Lord of the Rings. And it kept me in this fantasy world. And then we got back from Southeast Asia, and I was no longer an American child. I was now an Asian child. I had not seen television. I didn't know how to dress. I remember they told me my shorts didn't look right. I don't know if they were plaid or what the problem was, but I just remember I wasn't cool at all. But what was really cool is I had this friend who would tell me how I didn't dress cool and how to dress cool like an American child. And her father had, this is so exciting, her father had the best bakery in my hometown. And so I began with the best bakery at the age of 9, a long history of manipulation to get food. So I would say to her, don't you want to, like, don't you need to go buy your parents, you know, bakery? And they'd be like, no, they're fine. We can't do that. I wanted to go every day. I wanted to go every day. And they had the most amazing things. It was like Alice in Wonderland. You would come in there and they'd have black and white, like, milfoe and all amazing stuff. And they had cheese Danish, which I thought was the best marriage of food I'd ever heard of. You know, I was so excited about that. And then, fortunately or unfortunately, the ballet continued. For those of us who are dancers, and there are some in this room, ballet and pastry do not mix. And they just don't. And the profile at the time, that has changed a little bit, I think, but the profile at the time was a kind of super, super, super skinny. And I was a very devoted, serious student. And I could not get thin enough. I just couldn't. So by the age of about 12, I had decided there was something wrong with me. I just couldn't get thin enough. I got down to 125 pounds at this height, which is close to 5'7", 5'6 and a half, and I still had hips. And I didn't understand it because my girlfriends who were dancing were, you know, like, they seemed like they were, I'm looking down to see if I can measure it, they seemed like they were like 2 feet wide. And I would be told by these women that I adored and worshipped and venerated, these ballet instructors, they would say, well, you know, you're not thin enough to be in the Nutcracker. And it was a big deal. It was at the Opera House, and it was a really, really, really big deal. And, you know, my friends would play the leads, and they would say, well, you're not going to fit in the costume, so you can't do it. And take into consideration at this time, you know, I was not morbidly obese. So that went on for a long amount of time. I went to boarding school. There is not a lot to do in boarding school. Because there's no boys there, which is what I was interested in. But so what I did was eat a lot of ice cream. And when I mean a lot, I mean vats of it. I don't mean like a pint. I don't mean a gallon. I mean a large circular thing. And I would eat vats, just vats of it, vats of it. Because that's what we did to be rebellious, because we didn't have a lot to be rebellious about. And then I became a performer, and it started up all over again. Well, we wanted to hire Lucy, but she's a little hippie, quote-unquote, not meaning bohemian, a little hippie. You know, well, we wanted to hire Lucy, but, you know, you've got to lose X amount of weight. And like somebody was saying earlier tonight, I couldn't lose the weight. And I would go on the crazy diets. One diet was this fruit diet where you ate pineapple all day, which just made me completely nauseous and sick. And then there was another, my mother gave me a diet where you ate a grapefruit before every meal. and that was supposed to eat up the food you ate or something. I mean, I don't know what it was. I just remember there was a lot of boiled eggs on the diet. And then they had these revolting candy, which are called AIDS, A-Y-D-S, which is really unfortunate. And then you were supposed to eat those, and then I would go on these liquid diets, and then I would go to Weight Watchers and do all the counting, and I would make strange items with ricotta cheese. And anyway, so there was a lot of dieting. And then back in the day, didn't have gyms. They had these places where you would go and you would stand, and they would have belts, and they would just wiggle your fat. And you were supposed to lose weight. I don't know how, but you would just stand there, and they would say, "Look at Lucy. Doesn't she look amazing?" Well, because I would go through restricting phases. And there were phases. I am not a good restrictor. I sponsor some people who are awesome restrictors. I am not. I am not a good restrictor. It's like somebody just shared they could diet for 2.5 weeks. My longest period of restriction was 3 months at the age of 17, but that's because I was in love with somebody else's boyfriend. And so I was trying to get their attention, and I think I lost about 25 pounds by spitting cottage cheese into a wastebasket. I didn't actually know that there was there's actually a thing called spitting. I didn't know that. Just like I didn't know there was a thing called night eating. So I would take this food and I would spit it into a wastebasket. I was also smoking a lot of cigarettes, which helps if you don't want to eat. And I was drinking a lot of Perrier because Perrier was supposed to be very healthy. So that was, but it was like French and it was sparkling. So why not? You know, but that was the deal. I'm just checking my time. So that continued pretty much my whole life, you know, that obsession with weight. And the thing that compulsive overeating does for me, it does two things for me. One is it makes me feel not lonely. Like if I have food, I am not lonely. I have a friend, and then I turn on the television, and then I get really creative. Then I start making dips. Then I start going out and buying things. Then I start making cheesecakes. Then if I get really desperate, I'll open a bottle of wine. Then I'll go back to the salty. And this can take till 3 or 4 in the morning. This can go on a long time. And in the meantime, I'll be watching movies. So I will be in a coma of my own inducing. But I won't be lonely. It's what happens in the morning that is horrific. It's horrific for me. I can only talk about me. I can't talk about anybody else. But the self-hatred that I experience when I overeat or when I binge is something I would not wish literally on anybody. I'm thinking of people in history who maybe deserve it slightly, but I mean, not anybody. Not anybody. And I hate myself, and I have binary thinking. I have black and white thinking, which is I'm overeat, therefore I'm a bad person. I'm overweight, or what my definition of the overweight is. I honestly have no idea if I was or not, or I don't know. Like tonight I thought I looked really bad, and everybody's like, "Oh, you look really great." So I'm like, my opinion is useless. So, you know, fat was bad and thin was good in my head. And so I hated you if you were thin. I thought you were either really lucky, so I hated you because you were really lucky, or was jealous of you, or envious is probably more accurate, or I thought you were better than I was. And I was just naturally a bad person. I was just naturally a failure. I just naturally didn't have the kind of self-will it took to be a really successful human being. And that's what I would wake up in the morning with. And then I would check my hands and see how bloated they were. And they were sometimes so bloated that I couldn't get my rings off. I would have rings on and I couldn't get them off. And in college, I went through the same kind of loneliness. And what I would do is they only had English muffins in the kitchen. And I would make 8 English muffins at a time and put different toppings on them. And every night I would swear I'm never going to do this again. Because this is a disease, like the Big Book talks about. It's a disease of amnesia. It's really a disease of amnesia. And I forgot every night how horrible I felt in the morning, because the feeling of being so empty and the feeling of being so lonely, I couldn't tolerate. And I grew up in a really strict, in strict religious schools, so I thought God kind of hated me because I was not perfect. you know, I grew up with a kind of a culture of saints and sinning and confession, and I thought that God hated me because I wasn't perfect. So there was no God on my side. There was no God on my side. There was a God that's like waiting for Lucy to get her blank together. There's a God that was like really, you know, judging me for being less than. That's really what it was. So this continued really into my 50s. And what happened was, is I would wear strange clothes, really strange clothes to conceal what I thought my butt was. Like I would borrow my friend's father's bathrobe and wear like the bathrobe out, thinking it just looked kind of vintagey. Or people would have a pool party and I'd go swimming in my jeans. Like nobody's going to notice. I mean, I'm in a pool with jeans on, you know, and a bikini top. I mean, I was doing anything I could to hide my weight. You know, I think tying things around my waist or something like that. Oh, and then I got these blow-up pants that like are like a Michelin man, and I would blow them up. And that, and I found them recently. And I almost thought I should bring them to OA. They were like a curiosity, like archaeology. You know, like you blew them up, and they were supposed to make your hips and your stomach and your butt smaller. It did not work, but it made you very hot. But anyway, so this went on until I was about 50, and I went to see a food therapist, and she was a long-term abstaining member of Overeaters Anonymous. And she suggested I get into the program very gently, and it was good she did it gently because I don't like doing anything anybody tells me to do. I really don't. I'm really profoundly defiant. And I see it coming up in my marriage, and it's not a good thing. Okay, so I go to Paris on vacation, and you know how you go to Paris and you plan what you're going to see? Oh, no, I planned what I was going to eat. There was no sightseeing, there was no visiting, there was just eating. And I had a friend who lived there, and I said, okay, this is what I want to eat. I'm going to eat the oysters, get it all set up. But at that point, I had been going to this food therapist, and she had gotten me into a few OA meetings. So I had kind of had a taste of OA. I sort of had a sponsor. Now, take into consideration, it never occurred to me to call my sponsor from Paris. It never occurred to me to find Paris meetings, which are actually very good. It never occurred to me to do my step work in Paris. OA was something I dabbled in. I wasn't serious about it. So you can imagine what happened. I go to Paris, I binge, but I have enough OA in me to feel really bad about it. Really bad. Because you can't set up a meal. Like, I was going to go to Paris and have this perfect meal. Nothing can be that perfect. Nothing can fill that God-sized hole in me but something spiritual. Like my sponsor always says, if you can see it, it's not going to work to make you feel better. So I go to Paris, I ruin this amazing vacation, and I come home, and my dog has all these red spots on her. And I was like, what is that? And she was dying of some sort of really horrible disease. So I called my sponsor, and my sponsor was like, well, I haven't heard from you for a month. You know, you haven't done your step work. And so I moved on. And, you know, she's entitled to say that. It's not like, I do not blame her for saying this. And this is my sponsor before my current sponsor. And so she's entitled to say that, and she said it, and it woke me up. And my dog was dying, and I had binged my way through Paris. And at that point, I would do absolutely anything to get abstinent, anything to get abstinent. And so what happened was, is I called a friend of mine who was in AA, and he said, well, I'll call somebody. And he says, I found somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody. I said, okay. So I called her at like 5 o'clock on a Wednesday, and she picked up the phone, and she was like, well, you know, what do you do with food? And I was like, oh God, it was so scary. It was so scary talking to her. And she said, well, okay, meet me at Light a Candle, and where do you sit? I thought, where do I sit? I sit in the back of the room where nobody can see me. You got to be kidding. She said, okay, I'm in the front row, and this is what I look like. And I thought, oh, no, it's the scary girl. Oh, no, okay. Okay, so I got to talk to the scary girl. I was so scared. I was so scared. And I kept thinking, I'm a performer. I was terrified. But she told me what to do. She said, write about surrender, write a list of your red, yellow, and green light foods, and get 5 commitments and go to 5 meetings. Okay, I did not know what a commitment was. I had no idea. But I just said yes. because I didn't know what else to do. And I hated myself so much, and I was so at bottom that I just said, yes, I will go to 5 meetings a week. I will do 5 commitments. I will call you every day. Oh, and calling her every day was at 6:30 in the morning. I woke up at 9. So 6:30 in the morning, I was too scared to say no. So I said, yes, I'll call you every day at 6:30. And that's how I got abstinent. I went to a lot of meetings. She told me to make 2 outreach calls a day. I did that. I went to a lot of meetings. I worked the steps. I'm working the steps again right now, actually, which is a great experience, which I'm really enjoying a lot, which I never thought I would say. I was not one of these people that came into these rooms and was like, oh, I'm at home, and I love my people. Oh, no, no, no. I was not that way. I was like, don't touch me. Don't talk to me. I was, how different can I be? I didn't want to be like you. I didn't want to be like you. I wanted to be like some combination of a supermodel and a Nobel Prize winner. I did not want to be a normal person. And in this program, I have been given the gift of belonging. And there is nothing like that. There just is nothing like it. And I've been given the gift of not being lonely. You know, and the gift of spirituality. I mean, I was having kind of a grumpy day today, and I know what will not fix it. Nothing I buy will fix it. I can make a lot of outreach calls. I can talk to my sponsees. I have a lot of sponsees. They save my life. It used to really irritate me when they called. I'd be so mad. I'd be like, oh, my God, they called again. And, you know, and then like 5 or 6 of them would call, and then that would be even more irritating. But the truth is, that's what keeps me in the middle of the program. And listening to my sponsor keeps me in the middle of the program. My sponsor will often say to me that it's not just the direction, it's that you're submitting to somebody else's will. You're not listening to what's in your head. And so I would say that I have a very close relationship with my sponsor. I called her every day for years and years and years and years. I don't call her as much. I call her weekly now, for sure, for sure, for sure, and always more than once a week. But I also get to see her a lot at meetings, which works well for me. You know, I think if you're new, what I want to say is, just like Zan said, it's impossible to do this program wrong. Like, impossible. The only thing you can do wrong is leave. That's the only thing you could do wrong. And there's a lot of hope here, and how I know that for a fact is because I know my own story, and I came in with zero hope, zero. I did not think it would work. I just had done all the diets. I'd been to the hypnotherapists. I'd been to the crazy healers who gave me prayers and chants to say. Didn't work for me. You know, I'd been to the commercial diet programs. It didn't work for me. So in here, I found hope. In here, I found a connection to spirituality. What I do to work my program is every morning I get up, and the first thing I do is I read, and I read from various program literature. I do a reader. I usually read what I call source material, meaning directly from the mouths of Bill W. and the original kind of founders of AA. So I'll read either the Big Book or the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions, which is what I'm reading right now because I'm working the steps right now. I read about the early days in AA and how they started the traditions. I do a gratitude list of 10 things I'm grateful for. I do a two-way prayer. I write to my higher power and have my higher power write back. And then I do a meditation. In the old days when I started out, I did a 3-minute routine, and it's what I tell my sponsees to do, which is literally one reader. I usually did 4 today. One reader, which was 30 seconds, then the gratitude list, then a 1-minute meditation. But I've graduated. What I find from meditation is my mind is crazy. Somebody said earlier who took a candle, you know, that they're still batshit crazy, but that they use these steps to structure their life. And that's what I do. So I meditate, and a big part of the reason why I meditate is to watch the insanity and the restlessness I have, and the constantly searching for the answer, and the constantly searching for something that's going to calm me down, something that's going to give my life meaning. My sponsor teases me about this all the time because she says I like tend to be miserable. So I really try to look for the joy and try to look for the, you know, really great things that happen. And usually those are really, really small things. Like there's birds at my bird feeder, which is amazing to me. That's like higher power working in my life. Or the way my dog is, you know, that's higher power as well. I go to a lot of meetings. I'm in a number of different programs. I go to meetings almost daily. I'm really, really fortunate in that I love meetings. I mean, maybe it's just because I love the social aspect of it, but I think really it is that it keeps my mind quiet, because otherwise I don't want to be my husband. I just don't, because I'm going to think of something wrong with him and attack him and attack people around me and get squirrely and get weird. So I want to thank Lisanne for asking me to speak. I want to thank my sponsor, all my sponsees, and I really, really want to thank OA for bringing hope back into my life. And so my wish for those of you who are returning or those of you who are new is that you keep coming back and that you find what I found here. So thanks so much. So I will take questions if you have any. Mary Pat.
What do you think changed, you know, you used all those diets and stuff.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about what do you think changed to make the food part or, you know, diet part of OA stick in your experience or opinion?
So the question is, what do I think changed after doing all the commercials diets? To make the food part of OA stick, meaning stop dieting, right?
But yet, you had the food stuff be a problem, and it's something.
Right. That, yeah. Now, the food can still be a problem for me. There is no question about this. Sugar can still be a problem for me. So let's be honest on my part. Some people have the food removed completely. That is not the case with me, so I want to be really transparent about that. I think it was two things. Number one, I was exhausted. I was exhausted from dieting. I was exhausted from restricting. I was exhausted from working out to correct a problem. I work out now because I love it. I do dance, I do yoga, I do tap. I don't work out because my stomach's too fat, my thighs are blah, 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 blah. You know, I don't do that. I think the other thing is that the binging, I reached a bottom so low that with my dog dying, with ruining a vacation, with my sponsor firing me, I reached the bottom so low that I just couldn't binge anymore. I just couldn't do it, because what it did to me spiritually, what it did to me psychologically was so violent. It was so violent. Like, I couldn't tolerate the amount of self-hatred I had. So I was willing to eat less, and I was willing to stop. The other thing that always works, thank you, the other thing that always works so well I seldom do it, but it always works, is praying. If I pray when I can't stop eating, it always works. It's amazing. It's like magic. It's like I don't know how the OA program works. I just know that it does. And I know that it does because I'm looking out right now and I'm looking at people who came in this room after I did, and I watched it work for them. So, I hope that answers your question. Francesca.
Thank you. What do you do when those negative body thoughts come?
Okay, the question is, what do I do when those negative body thoughts come? Okay, so my negative body thoughts still come. And I do not engage in the behaviors that I used to engage in. So, that is trying on 7 pairs of jeans to see which one is the tightest and which one fits. Checking the size on the jeans. Checking my stomach all the time in the mirror. I do not do that. What I try to do is this. I try to approach it more spiritually. And I try to really, this sounds so weird, but I try to really thank my body for being so good to me for 60 plus years. And I have abused it so badly. So I try to really be grateful for the fact I'm incredibly healthy. I can work out. I can basically do almost any sport I wanted. I mean, somebody suggested a hiking trip to me today in which you're hiking, holding onto a chain with a 3,000-foot drop. And I was like, no. But I can do virtually any sport. So I try to, I think the negative body talk, I combat it with gratitude, and I combat it also with contrary action. So maybe I'll take a walk. Maybe I'll call a fellow and I'll ask them how they're doing. I won't necessarily say, hey, I am obsessed with my rear end. I will not say that. I will just ask them, how are you guys doing? So it's taking the contrary action, and it's also acting better than you feel. This is something I really dislike. I actually dislike acting better than I feel because I like being tragically, like, angst-ridden. So, you know, I will, like, start smiling at people. And I will do all that just so that otherwise the negative body thoughts, they take up space in my head, and all of a sudden I'm shopping because I think that if I order clothes from London or get more Spanx, that I'm going to look thinner. And it doesn't work. Yes?
My question is, you mentioned that one of the reasons you ate was because of loneliness.
Yeah.
And when you were eating, you didn't feel lonely anymore. When you put down the food, how did you combat those feelings as they come up?
Okay, so the question is, when I put down the food, how did I combat the feelings of loneliness? A ton of meetings. I go to a ton of meetings. And I listen to speakers. I did it more when I was new before, but I listened to speakers. So I surrounded myself with OA so that I was never alone. I would have CDs, which I would play in the car. Now you can do podcasts, so that's easy. Made outreach calls. So I didn't allow those feelings of profound loneliness. And sometimes I just had to live through them. And sometimes I could write about it. Lots of times I would call my sponsor and she would make a suggestion. It was usually a suggestion I didn't like. But suggestions I don't like always work. Suggestions I don't like always, always, always work. It's just like when service is inconvenient, it works really well. Doing service always works. Picking up somebody, driving them to the meeting, asking them how they're doing, making a call. Go ahead, Sam.
Thank you, Lucy. I think you have already articulated this in many different ways, but could you talk about how self-centeredness is the root of our disease?
Okay, the question is, how is self-centeredness the root of our disease? It is definitely the root of my disease. It's so much the root of my disease, I forgot to mention it. But, yeah, it is really the root of my disease. And self-everything. Self-obsessed, you know, self-remorseful. You can just put self in the middle, in the front of everything. I think how it's the center of our disease is it's the obsession with how you look. And really, how you look is such an extraordinarily minuscule thing to the extraordinary, magnificent human beings we all are. And I think what the 12-step does, and Seppi alluded to this earlier, what the 12 steps do for me is they strip me of ego. And then the ego comes back, and I have to do it again, and I have to be reminded, and then God reminds me by throwing something in my path. It's a little challenging. But, you know, it says, I think in the big book, or it might be in the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions, it says our egos have to be smashed. And I find that word so incredible, so beautiful, because it's not our egos need to be avoided, our egos need to be tiptoed around. It's like our egos need to be smashed. And I think when I put myself behind myself, I sort of think of that. Like, if my ego is like a big ball or a big, large, inflatable doll, and I kind of put it behind so that I can not compete with somebody else, not judge somebody else, so that I can just be there and listen to them and have an experience with them as opposed to thinking, why are they wearing those shoes? Or, you know, or like, why did they say that? They don't even know who so-and-so is. Which all these thoughts come to me all the time. And they keep me from my higher power and they keep me from other people. And the glory of other people and the connection to other people is what connects me to my higher power. You know, and that connects me to that flow of goodness. And, I mean, I sound like a like insight timer tape, but that flow, that real flow of love and of goodness that happens, you know, that happens when I'm not, you know, chasing myself and obsessed with myself.
Can you talk about how you came to know a higher power that really works for you?
The question is, how did I come to know a higher power that really works for me? Okay. This is a tough question for me because I did come from an atmosphere of really fairly severe judgment from a higher power, and it also was a tough question for me because I came from a lot of arrogance, because I had I'm just arrogant. There is no because, but there was a lot of. I went to a lot of religious schools, so I was like, oh, prayers. I know prayers. Oh, I got that. But I watched my sponsor. I really watched my sponsor, and I watched the kind of opening that she got from, and she would say, get on your knees and ask your higher power, and I would do that. So I acted as if, before I acted, I actually believed. Or she'd say, why don't you pray before you eat? Or she'd say, why don't you ask your higher power? Or why don't you write about it? You know, and so I would take all these actions that got me closer to the higher power, even though I didn't believe it. You know, it's kind of like the way I meditated. I meditated completely distracted, completely. I still occasionally do. But just the act of doing it helped me. And then I find my higher power a lot in nature. I just find that's nature and in animals. That's kind of what soothes me and comforts me. And so that was a big part of the journey as well.
Hi, I'm Carlo. I'm a reader.
Hey, Carlo.
First of all, thank you. Second, the question would be, when things are going well, how do you manage that from not going into, feeling so comfortable that you loosen up and set yourself up for a relapse?
Okay, when things are going well, how do I not set myself up for a relapse and get so comfortable? First of all, I'm never convinced things are going well. So that right, that's what I have to work on. So that's not a problem there. But there are a lot of times when things are going well, and I constantly remind myself the priorities. I'm very clear that my number one priority is the 12 steps. I'm really clear about that. My sponsor has ground that into me. And so when I make choices, I go, okay, here are the choices. I can do this, I can do this, I can do this. Okay, where do the 12 steps fit in here? So I'm constantly placing OA, and I'm constantly placing my other programs at the top of the pile, because I'm very aware of what I'm capable of losing. And I've seen people lose it, and it was really tough coming back. And I don't want to relapse. It took me 2 years to get abstinent. I don't want to relapse. And I also feel a little bit like I'm too old to relapse. What's that mean? I'm in my 60s. I don't have a 30-year relapse to go out and come back, you know. But really, it is because I really prioritize, and that's what I've been trained to do. That's what I've been trained to do, and that has really, really worked for me. That's not something that I invented on my own. That comes from a long line of sponsorship. And if there is something, recently my husband wanted to take me out for Valentine's Day, I'll run it by my, thank you, Aaron, I'll run it by my sponsor and say, you know, is it okay, I'm not going to this meeting, I'm going to go out for Valentine's Day. So thank you for your question.